Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Robert, I got a question for you.
Hit me.
What do you think is the most isolated and confined workspace in the world? Immediately, you want to think about the International Space Station, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty isolated. You think about going into orbit. Mm-hmm. You think about maybe going to the North or South Pole, or perhaps being on a ship in just the middle of the ocean, just, you know, just leagues upon leagues away from shore.
But, you know, when you think about it, if you, say, are on an Antarctic research station that's mm-hmm. overwintering at the South Pole, maybe you're doing neutrino research or something down there, you might in some cases have the ability to, say, look out windows
at
least maybe go outside for short periods of time.
Yeah, or even if you're just stranded in the middle of the ocean, you can at least look up at that albatross, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, you get a sense that there's something traveling somewhere. How about the International Space Station? That's got to be the most isolated and confined and maybe claustrophobic, right? Because you're in a can flying around at super high altitude around the Earth. There's no way to get back down quickly or easily. But then again, I think about the windows.
Yeah.
When you're on the International Space Station, apparently they say lots of the astronauts up there spend huge amounts of their free time just looking out the windows, looking at the surface of the Earth, kind of letting that work on their consciousness and massage their brains. What would it be like to be on the International Space Station if there were no windows?
Yeah, because a lot has been said about looking out, seeing the Earth from above, experiencing what do we know now as the overview effect, mm-hmm. you know, almost a semi-religious experience. But if you didn't have those windows, if you were just sealed up within a tube in this extreme environment, well, then that would be a lot like another extreme environment that we sometimes send people. Not outer space, but inner space.
Wait, you mean that movie where they inject you into the bloodstream?
That's right. We're not talking about entering the bloodstream of Martin Short.
He's the one they go into?
Yeah, he's the subject, as I recall.
I don't think I've actually seen that movie.
Oh, what? You've got to see it. It's tremendous fun. I remember watching it as a kid. It has all these cool little submarines that move around inside the bloodstream.
The action scene where Martin Short suddenly eats a Cheeto and they have to fight it off.
Yeah.
But no, no, no. You're talking about another kind of environment that's more confining, more of a crushed can of an existence without any ability to make contact with the world below or the world above. You're talking about life aboard a nuclear submarine.
Yes, and you're certainly not going to get the overview effect. As we'll discuss in this episode, perhaps you'll get something more like the underview effect.
Now, Robert, you have used this metaphor for submarines in our notes here, calling them the arcs of doom. I don't know where you got that or if that's just out of your brain, but I love it.
Well, there's arcs with a K, so right. I'm thinking like Noah's arcs, Noah's Ark here. The idea is it's hard enough for us to sleep just knowing that dozens of nuclear ballistic missile submarines haunt the world's oceans, each containing the means to rain nuclear annihilation down on the world. But what's it like to sleep aboard these arcs of doom, if you will? It actually ties into long-term military study, and the results may actually help us send humans to other planets one day.
Right. So today we're going to be talking a little bit about life and sleep and a little bit about psychological health aboard these deep arcs of doom.
Now, I want to throw in a quick note. I know we've covered a fair amount of underwater episodes this year.
Have we now?
Yeah, we have. underwater humanoids, the bathysphere, et cetera. We keep returning to the ocean. And really, I guess that's unavoidable because we live on a water world. Mm-hmm. The ocean is where we encounter all these various mysteries and all of these fabulous stories of scientific exploration and mythic dreaming.
It's the part of space we explore that actually has aliens.
Right. And so we couldn't decide on the show not to cover the underwater realm, even if someone demanded that we do so. But one of the reasons that I've been drawn to a lot of underwater topics this year is because I've been writing an upcoming sci-fi underwater podcast for How Stuff Works.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Robert.
Oh, thank you.
This is where we're saying it in public.
That's right. We're letting it leak out a little bit here. And Joe, you're going to actually be on it as well. We've got a wonderful little part lined up for you.
I'm sure it'll be magnificently dehumanizing.
All right. Well, speaking of dehumanization, let's get back to this world of nuclear submarines and why we have them to begin with.
Yeah, what are nuclear submarines? You've heard the phrase, but why do we have nuclear submarines? Is the Cold War still going on?
Well, that's a loaded question, isn't it? we should talk just a minute about submarines. So I have to admit, when I was a kid, my understanding of submarines was largely based on World War II era books and documentaries and movies, stuff like Das Boot, mm-hmm. about the German submarines, U-boats.
You're thinking about like an attack U-boat, like sinking a cargo ship or something.
Yeah. They're also called hunter-killer submarines. They're mm-hmm. going to be taking out enemy war vessels or cargo ships or occasionally interacting with other submarines. And certainly, various nations on Earth still employ attack subs. And some of these are nuclear-powered, and they can go out on prolonged missions and spend a lot of time beneath the waves. But then there's the nuclear-powered ballistic missile sub. And this is a different beast altogether.
Yeah, these are sometimes referred to as strategic submarines. They're not made for battle tactics and combat. They are strategic as part of the nuclear triad.
That's right. The nuclear triad is essentially a defense/offense strategy concerning the possibility of nuclear war.
Right. It's part of the mutually assured destruction deterrent system.
Yeah. If you hit me with nuclear weapons, I will hit you with nuclear weapons, and then everybody loses, that sort of thing. But in order to fully offer that vision of doom, you have to essentially have these three things lined up according to the nuclear triad. You need strategic bombers.
Okay, so those would be flying around in the air.
Mm-hmm. You need intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs.
So these would be launched from launch sites.
Right, and then can travel ideally anywhere in the world or at least far enough to reach the key targets of interest.
Okay.
And then there are the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, or SLBMs, and that's what would be launched from these submarines.
Now, these are really key for a very specific reason. Imagine you've got a bunch of intercontinental ballistic missiles, and the reason you say you have them, at least – and by the way, I don't want to say we're necessarily advocating like the goodness of nuclear weapons or the correctness of nuclear weapons defensive strategy. But this is how the mutually assured destruction system is supposed to work in theory. The idea is you have all these nuclear weapons to prevent anyone from attacking you, because they can be assured that if they attack you, then you will respond with devastating force, and that's supposed to prevent nuclear war from ever breaking out in the first place. Nobody can strike first because they would get hit back so hard. But under that logic, if that's actually working, there is a problem with the idea of there just being ground-based launch areas, because what if one side says, okay, so we've got really good surveillance and we've got spies, and now we think we know where, you know, at least 90% of their launch sites are. So what if we can launch a first strike and take out all of their launch sites to begin with?
Then, likewise, the same applies to the strategic bombers, because you could say, well, we know where their airfields are, and or we know where the planes are in the air that are out on regular maneuvers.
Yeah, we can use radar. So we can figure that stuff out. What if you get one side saying, we think we could launch a first strike and mostly get away with it? You know, we can prevent their ability to strike back. So then submarines really become important to maintain the deterrence, as the theory goes, because if you have submarines capable of launching nukes from all over the world and the enemy can't really know where they are, they're hidden under the ocean somewhere and you can't find them, then it ups the deterrence. It basically makes it say, no, you can't launch a first strike and just get away with it.
It's like in a crime movie where one character is you know, basically at gunpoint or at knife point, and they tell the villain, you can't kill me because if I die, I have a mysterious friend who will deliver a letter to the newspaper.
Right. It's in a safe deposit box. Yeah. You know, you can't know where it is, but if I die, it's going to become public.
And that's the basic concept here. Now, SLBMs, they emerged during the Cold War as a reality, but the idea goes back to World War II. The Germans were actually working on a submarine launch platform for their V-2s, their vengeance weapons, these large rockets that could be used to attack other countries.
It's one of the very commonly contemplated nightmare scenarios of alternative history is imagining what would have happened in World War II if the Nazis had had greater technological advances in their weaponry.
Right. And they already had significant technological advances. But a lot of these ideas, they were not able to really get outside of the testing zone on.
Right.
And this was one of those. They never tested it. But the architects of this and other weapon systems, of course, continued their work in the U.S. and in the USSR.
Right, which led to a not alternative history, but the real history terrifying scenario of mutually assured destruction and, you know, the constant sort of hair trigger alert system on which we kept all these nuclear weapons and nuclear strategic submarines throughout the Cold War.
Yeah, and anyone who's really interested in this topic, definitely go check out our episode, There But For Science. Because that was an episode where we talked about communication with nuclear submarines and how we actually do it, and then this one alleged scheme to try and carry out secret communication with nuclear subs via essentially blood magic.
That was a weird episode, but I liked
it. It was, yeah.
Basically the idea is that maybe according to some anecdotes, the Soviets were working on tests to use psychics to communicate with strategic submarines. I mean, who knows if that's exactly true, but that's at least what was alleged.
I'll make sure there's a link to it on the landing page for this episode. I feel like it kind of fell through the cracks for some listeners. So we have these vessels out there, and again, we have nuclear power on board. So, you know, they're not having to worry about filling up at the local gas station. But they require a human crew. The crew has to work in a very confined environment, and they have to stay submerged the entire time for months at a time. Though the main restriction apparently on such nuclear-powered subs is food. And I've read that the meals get kind of interesting towards the end of the mission when they're running out of stuff to cook. There's a straight dope message board user who mentioned, quote, chili mac with a side of canned beets as an example.
I read another example from some user somewhere about going for like weeks at a time at the end of the mission, just getting pancakes. Every meal was pancakes for weeks.
Well, you know how it is when you make pancakes. You have all that leftover batter. So do you put the batter away? Do you throw it out? Or do you just keep making pancakes? Clearly, the answer is just keep making pancakes until you return to port.
I mean, I hope they were real buttermilk pancakes. That buttermilk makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, all that said, I've actually also read that when it's fresh, submarine food is supposed to be about the best food you get in the armed forces. Have you read about this, Robert?
Yeah, I've seen that cited as one of the reasons sailors actually go after the submarine assignment,
yeah,
is that there's going to be great food.
Yeah, so – and that's supposed to basically be an incentive, one of the incentives to draw sailors into this – in many ways, very undesirable task of mm-hmm. serving for months at a time on a deep sea submarine where you're not going to get to see the sun or look at a tree or see your family or any of that good stuff. At least you'll get some tasty food, hopefully for as long of the trip as that's possible, though, you know, who knows, if you're out there too long and the supplies haven't been planned quite right, then you might get some weird stuff later on. I read an article in the LA Times about how good submarine food is supposed to be. This was by a writer named Peter Pei. Just to read a quote from this, he's talking about a specific meal being served within the submarine. Quote, on cue, mess specialist Richard Yowen begins slicing a 25-pound prime rib roast into half-inch thick pieces before gingerly transferring the second entree, baked lobster tails with spicy Old Bay seasoning, onto a serving tray. Sautéed mushrooms, baked potatoes, and beef rice soup come next, with baskets full of hot oven-baked bread that was made from scratch. For dessert, Yuhan, a petty officer third class and former French pastry baker from Cyprus, has prepared chocolate and lemon cakes made with real chocolate and freshly squeezed lemon juice.
Oh, wow.
That is not what I would expect. I mean, I would have thought if you're on a submarine, you'd want to pack a lot of extremely non-perishable, calorie-rich, dense foods. So a lot of like canned meat and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Because space is at such a premium.
Yeah, absolutely. They're just packed in there. So you would think that the food would be something that's very conducive to that environment.
But on the other hand, the psychological well-being of the crew is really important in a deep-sea submarine. You don't want your strategic submarine to be full of people having deep-sea madness because they've been eating Spam for months.
Right. You don't want that Spam sandwich to be the straw that breaks the camel's back for their sanity.
Yeah, it will not be your ice cream bar.
Because obviously you're stuck in a very contained environment with the same people and, of course, the same air.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a good question. So you might be thinking, wait. So you're saying that this nuclear submarine gets into a strategic launch position. It's a secret. It can't come to the surface or it might be detected. So it's got to stay down for maybe months at a time, at least weeks at a time. And the main problem is running out of food? Why wouldn't they run out of air first? That seems obvious, right?
Right, yeah. You would think, I'm going to be stuck underwater. I want to get the air situation taken care of before I wonder about my lobster tails.
It seems a little important, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's like you have to choose between eating and breathing. I mean, I love food, but I would probably pick breathing. So obviously, it would be difficult for a submarine to bring along enough oxygen tanks and it could be dangerous to bring along enough compressed oxygen for crew members to breathe for 90 days. So how do the humans on board a submarine get fresh, breathable air? Well, think about it. What do you have in abundance that you can work with on a deep sea submarine with a nuclear reactor inside of it?
Well, you've got power.
That's right. You got electricity and you got, of course, plenty of water. So nuclear submarines have the power to actually create fresh oxygen using oxygen generators. And this is done through a process known as electrolysis. So a water molecule is H2O. It's two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. And if you apply a strong chemical current to a container of water in the right way, it'll split into its atomic constituents. Those water molecules will break up under the influence of the electrical energy, and they'll release oxygen gas and hydrogen gas. This is actually sort of the inverse of what happens in a hydrogen fuel cell, right? A fuel cell combines hydrogen and oxygen to produce electricity and water. This process combines electricity and water to produce hydrogen and oxygen. Now, of course, if you think about things like the Hindenburg, it can sound kind of scary to have pure hydrogen and pure oxygen in your submarine, right?
Yeah, that sounds explosive.
Yeah, I mean, and we can actually think back to tragedies in the history of space exploration where, you know, enriched oxygen environments led to deadly fires, mm-hmm. right? So you want to be careful when dealing with pure hydrogen or high oxygen content in your environments. So you've got to get rid of that excess hydrogen for one thing. So the oxygen is preserved for atmospheric circulation, but then the hydrogen byproduct of the electrolysis is purged into seawater or burned in a controlled system. And of course, that's not the only issue with breathable air, right? You also have to worry about the toxic byproducts of human respiration, like CO2. And there they use chemical scrubbers, right? Like a monoethanol amine can be used to absorb carbon dioxide, and then that can be purged.
Now, this would, of course, be a more robust system than what we saw in the bathysphere, where you just had trays of chemicals lining the top of the sphere.
Yeah, just what did they have? It was basically just like a tray of lime or something.
Yes, yes. Something to that effect.
I don't remember exactly what it was. It was something like that. But yeah, so you clearly start to get a sense of the delicate balance that one must maintain in a pressurized environment in a submarine deep under the ocean where, of course, if there was to be a leak or something like that, you know, you could have the depths and compression of the seawater kill you. You could have contaminants in the atmosphere inside the submarine kill you. You've also just got super cramped conditions. Everything's tight everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it starts to make you wonder, what's it like to be one of these people aboard the submarine? What's it like to be a submariner? How does that get to your psychological health? And how does it affect your daily patterns of behavior and things like sleep?
Exactly. And that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this episode. We're going to look at a few different papers that have come out over the years that try and get to the bottom of just what's going on with a submariner's sleep. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back. So one of the sources we looked at for this episode is a 1969 paper titled Human Adjustment to an Exotic Environment, the Nuclear Submarine, by Jim H. Earls, MD of Oklahoma City. And this was based in part on his observations as a doctor aboard two nuclear-propelled Polaris missile-firing submarines. And it's a very readable paper.
Oh, yeah.
And while it's nearly half a century old at this point, we do have to recognize, and it doesn't attempt to speak to the conditions on all subs, it's still worth discussing. It still makes some in a way, it's one of the more useful papers that's come out because he's willing to just sort of observe the Submariner in its unnatural environment, almost like it's an animal.
Yes, and a passionate animal at that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of this it's almost borderline Freudian, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's talking a lot about how different types of mood affects, but also urges and things like that, and how they get elevated or sublimated. It's a really interesting read.
All right, so we're gonna move through the paper here and touch on some of the high points. So he pointed out that, quote, the U.S. Navy, in apparent recognition of man as the limiting factor, has elected to man each Polaris submarine with two complete crews. These crews alternate between being on the submarine for about 90 days and receiving refresher training at the U.S. Navy base. This method of manning the Polaris submarine has apparently been adopted to obtain the maximum submerged patrol time on a continuing basis. So the idea here is, yeah, people are going down for months at a time on this, but then they have to bring it back. They have to bring the submarine back. They have to put in a new crew and also do some maintenance on the vehicle before it goes back out again.
Yeah, and apparently something that was true both then and now is that if you want to be on a submarine crew, you have to go through a lot of training and screening ahead of time.
That's right. They're screening for intellectual level, emotional stability, physical status.
And they just run tests on you, right, you know, for mm-hmm. basically your submarine competence.
Yeah, and each of the subs that the author here discusses would have been crewed by 140 men, and they would live there 60 days at a time, and then there would be this 28-day upkeep interval.
Yeah, but of course, one thing when you think about on a submarine is you just mentioned like length of days. So you imagine you're on a submarine at the bottom of the ocean for 60 days.
Yeah.
What does 60 days mean at the bottom of the ocean? Obviously, there is still a measurable length of time. Like you could count out the hours, and it's not like a general relativity issue. Like it's still the same number of hours that the surface would measure. But if you're never seeing the sun rise and set, and you're never seeing the moon, and you're never hearing the crickets chirp at night, and you never hear the rooster crow in the morning, and nothing happens to mark the sort of the daily milestones of the passage of time, what do days mean?
Well, this is where Earls describes it as quote, some loss of circadian and geographical orientation.
So you'd imagine.
Yeah. So your body's not really sure what time it is. And so you're getting into this, what I've seen referred to in some papers as diurnal flattening. Mm-hmm. And then you have no idea where you are, really. I mean, you know you're under the sea. You know you're deep in the ocean. And perhaps, depending on, you know, who you are in the crew, perhaps you know more specifically where you are. But it doesn't – how much does that – what does that mean to you if you can't actually observe it?
Yeah. So you're operating somewhat independently of the passage of days and nights on the surface. So if you still want to operate on the basis of days, there being such a thing as a day and that mattering, what do you have to judge that by?
Well, Earl says you have the meals. You have your three meals a day.
Okay.
And then you have the evening movie. And these become the pillars of your understanding of time.
I wonder what movies they were showing on submarines in the 1960s.
Oh, man. I'd have to really dive into IMDb. But I'm guessing they were probably – they probably weren't watching submarine pictures that much, I assume. I'm guessing they were watching, you know, stuff with some nice beach scenes, maybe some beach comedies.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say the submarine brought along one movie. The movie was Monster a Go-Go, and they just watched it every night.
Oh, that is not – unless it is a legitimate psychological experiment, I don't see that going over well.
I mean, it's about the right time period. I think it works.
Yeah. Well, I can see monster movies as being the type of thing that would go over well.
Oh, I would love to watch monster movies on a submarine. I just would want to be able to leave the submarine afterwards.
Yeah. And now on top of this, Earl points out that you're in a very stationary world, but one where there's just constant white noise. It's like being in a white noise machine, and then the only time you really notice what's going on is if there's some change in the white noise.
Yeah.
And then you might wonder what's wrong, what's changed.
Exactly. I mean, he describes the white noise as being sort of part of a larger background of not just the sound, but a white background, like a totally mm-hmm. unchanging environment.
Yeah.
That your environment is just static and nothing happens to it. There's no weather. There's no day-night cycle. It's like living a purely artificial existence.
Right. And then you have almost no private space. He points out that like the room you watch the movies in, it's not like they would have had a dedicated movie theater. No, that was some other space, perhaps where you ate, that got converted. If some sort of medical procedure needed to be conducted, that would take place in one of these rooms as well. So mm-hmm. everybody's sharing the same space. Spaces are being used for different purposes. And he paints a picture of like basically just crawling all over each other. I think one of the problems for us surface folk trying to figure out what it's like to be in a submarine is we have all these submarine movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the submarine sets, I've always enjoyed this, like watching an old submarine movie especially and seeing how large they make the space appear, because you need enough space for a fist fight usually.
Yeah. Oh, they seem quite spacious.
Mm-hmm.
I think about scenes in The Hunt for Red October where people are like running around and there are these rooms with all this like empty floor space.
Yeah. It's been a long time since I've seen Das Boot. So I could be completely wrong, but I seem to remember there being a lot of really cramped sets in mm-hmm. that movie. But
I'm sure some movies do it better than others.
Yeah. But some of them just really go wide. Like, basically, you have a basketball court in there.
What's that room in The Hunt for Red October? I remember there's a scene on the Soviet sub where they start singing the national anthem, and it's in this, like, if my memory is right, it's this, like, echoey hall.
Oh, wow. It's been too long since I've seen that.
Well, I've maintained for years that they should turn The Hunt for Red October into a Broadway musical. Seriously, I've got it all planned out. I think, like, I've got some of the songs written. I think it could be really good.
Oh, wow. Well, that's how I want to see this movie again, then, as a musical.
All the songs are written by Jim Steinman, so they're very punny. There's one called, like, A Lesson in Tactics.
All right. Very rock-oriented as well.
That's all I got right now.
Okay. You're not going to sing anything?
No.
Okay. Now, on top of
no, wait, starring Meatloaf as Captain Ramius. Okay, that's
God,
all I got.
That would
I'm
be
done.
Good. That would
I'm
be
done.
Good. All right, so on top of all this we've discussed so far, Earls also mentions that, I mean, at the heart of this, you have this terrible purpose. Mm-hmm. Like every day is pretty going to be much the same, ruled by routine. Nothing is really happening aboard one of these subs.
Uh-huh.
But if it does happen, if the submarine's key purpose comes into play, that is because it is involved in a nuclear exchange. He says the Submariner is also aware that these missiles are to be fired only in retaliation to a nuclear attack on the United States.
So if they do the job that is sort of like their primary potential job down there, mm-hmm. it's only because something terrible has happened to the world.
Yeah, something just horrifying has occurred. And it, of course, raises all these questions. Like the family that you're potentially separated from, the world, the daily life that you were dreaming of in the sub, what has happened to it? You've had to act, and what kind of world are you going to surface to?
Earl says this sort of leads to this feeling of avoidance about the idea, and also the idea that the quote payload mm-hmm. is referred to in highly technical terms. Like they don't necessarily talk about the nuclear missiles.
Right.
They talk about it in abstracted, euphemistic, technical type words.
Now, one of the cool things he does in this article is he divides up the mission into four phases.
Yeah, I like this.
Yeah, he talks about like the opening weeks and how people are feeling about things, and then how their psychological condition seems to change. Basically, what is the timeline? What are the ups and downs from departure to return?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what we've been talking about here occurs during that initial phase, the first week or so. But he says that during the second week of submergence, the crew members begin to experience sleep disturbances. And this, he says, can range from insomnia to hypersomnia. So not being able to sleep or sleeping way too much.
That seems like normal kinds of reactions you might expect from being confined to an artificial environment without natural light or changes mm-hmm. in light.
Yeah, your circadian rhythm's all over the place. And this is what he calls the first quarter syndrome. And there's another interesting aspect of first quarter syndrome that he points out, and that is gang behavior.
Specifically, he says, quote, adolescent gang behavior, because he talks about how the parts, you know, the different crews within the submarine, sort of the sub crews, like you've got the sonar crew, mm-hmm. you've got the weapons crew or the missile crew, you've got the navigation crew. They all sort of break into their own natural tribes because they work with one another, mm-hmm. and they will essentially behave like gangs against one another, pranking one another, stealing totemic objects from the other gangs.
That's what you want to hear about, adolescent pranks on a nuclear submarine.
It's tactics within strategy and strategy within tactics.
So the mission continues, and you're going to reach the point where what Earls calls halfway syndrome kicks in. And this, he says, is going to be characterized by depression, complaints.
Very subjective complaints, right?
Yeah, he says the major portion of the crew experience changes in appetite, changes in bowel function, headaches, muscle aches, difficulty in concentration, and sleep disturbances on top of just general pessimism and boredom.
Now, before this stage, Earls mentions that there is a lot of joking among the crew, especially sexual jokes.
Yeah, and this would, I guess, be coming into play during the pranking period as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not – I guess that's part of the cliche, right, is
right.
that sailors are going to tell dirty jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that at this stage, the humor actually changes in tone, right, and in content.
Yeah, it goes from being mostly sexual to being sarcastic humor.
There was an interesting section I just wanted to read from Earls about this. He says, quote, "This change in humor style appears to serve two functions. One is the discharge of hostile and aggressive affect, which is personally and culturally unacceptable and which might otherwise be physically acted out. The second is the keeping of the other shipmates at a comfortable distance, resulting in the temporary expansion of an individual's personal territory."
Huh.
I thought that was really interesting about the idea of changes in just types of humor playing these very important psychological roles, one of which is that obviously when you're living in a cramped space with a bunch of other dudes, especially if they're doing adolescent pranks and stuff, mm-hmm. you're going to start getting mad. And you want to display anger, but that's not acceptable under the command structure for Navy officers, right?
Right. And also it's just such an enclosed, tight environment. Like there's almost literally no room for that kind of response.
Yeah, exactly. So you can't lash out in anger at mm-hmm. your crewmates. So you have to sublimate the anger somehow, and it turns into this sort of hard-edged, sarcastic humor. And the other part being, if you're sarcastic with people, you psychologically keep them at an arm's length. When you're sarcastic, it sort of makes you more invulnerable and keeps people more separate apart from you, discourages emotional vulnerability and this feeling of closeness with others, which actually helps make you feel like you've got a bubble of personal space around you, even if it's only imaginary and psychological.
Now, he says that occasionally during this period, you'll have some individuals who begin to complain about the loss of normal circadian clues and may eventually report, quote, brief derealization or depersonalization-like episodes.
That's creepy.
And then three-quarters syndrome sets in. And then he says this is a sudden but short-lived elevation of mood. I guess that the idea is, hey, we're over the hump. We're essentially on the way back, sort of. And at this point, we'll see the sexual humor return, he says.
Okay.
And then in the final weeks, we see an elevation in mood. There was some anxiety about a return to the surface life, you know, without the structure of the submarine world, at least for some of the individuals. And then also a diminished need for sleep among some.
Yeah, I also thought this section was interesting because Earls talks about the stresses of the environment in a way being offset mm-hmm. by a kind of strange set of psychological circumstances fostering a mindset of childlike dependence. He writes, quote, "The sailor has been living in an emotionally stressful environment, but an environment which also regularly, reliably, and abundantly met his physical needs, with the singular exception of sex. The sailor has not had to employ even the normal terrestrial maneuvers needed to obtain food, shelter, clothing, etc. By necessity, all has been provided for him. It is not uncommon during the submerged patrol to hear the submariner make joking references to returning to the womb, and he is capable of recognizing the omnipresent justification for his remark."
Yeah, I found this really interesting as well because I feel like I can relate to a certain extent. Like there have been times – I don't get sick that often. But when I do get like truly sick, there's almost a comfort at times mm-hmm. in this becoming your sort of prime adversary in life, this being the prime battle. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to stop puking. And when that's accomplished, then I can worry about all the other paper tigers in my world.
Well, also, it might be the case – I mean it might not be the case, but it might be the case when you're sick that you have – other people doing more to take care of you directly
yeah.
than you normally would. Normally, these are things you need to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're sick, sometimes family members or friends will do things to take care of you and watch out for you. And it can create this feeling of like almost not wanting to return to the self responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. Like you've been able to at least get one leg out of the adult world and back into the world of childhood.
Yeah, one interesting point of comparison I thought was that was in observed patterns of adaptation to wintering in the Antarctic. So you imagine you're in an Antarctic research station and you know, you're trying to get through the winter. It's sort of like being in a submarine, not quite as confined as being totally submerged in a submarine, but you're basically stuck inside. And when you're in that environment, apparently military subjects showed very similar types of symptoms to what Earls is reporting from the submariners, like depressive symptoms. But the civilians apparently did not show similarly depressive symptoms and instead showed symptoms of anger and wrath lashing out that the military subjects basically couldn't display because it was not acceptable as part of their culture.
Here's a quote from Mullen. Quote, "We were impressed by the relative absence of overtly expressed hostility. Group and individual tensions and irritations are ever present, but the most important lesson a wintering over man learns is that he cannot afford to alienate the group. That in this tight little society, he is dependent in large measure upon the goodwill of the next man and of the group as a whole for his vital feelings of security, worth, and acceptance."
Makes you think about the nature of small group tribal existence as well.
Yeah.
Like how do group dynamics change when the people around you are essential for your survival and you know you can't get away from them?
Yeah. I mean, it almost feels like a team building exercise, right?
Yeah.
And instead of doing icebreakers, you just need to, you know, get your IT team and just put them in a submarine for 3 months.
Now, there are a lot of reasons that this research we've been talking about, this sort of set of case studies from 1969, might not be applicable to what life could be like on submarines today. I'm sure a lot of the same conditions are present, but things have probably changed a lot too in technological ways, mm-hmm. in social and psychological ways. One thing I definitely wonder about is the extent to which these symptoms would remain the same or change in a mixed gender crew environment, as opposed to the all-male crews of the late 60s?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we did look at some other information about sleeping upon a military submarine. There was a 1981 Naval Submarine Medical Research Laboratory report on work and rest on nuclear submarines. And I'm just going to roll through the key findings here. This paper was not nearly as delightful as the Earl's paper.
A little more clinical.
Yeah. So they pointed out that the workload of the average submariner averages about 12 hours a day with considerable individual variation. The smallest 30-day average recorded was 7.4 hours, and the largest was 15.6 hours. They said the sleeping habits were affected by the 18-hour activity cycle created by the 6 hours on, 12 hours off watch schedule. Said sleep may be considered mildly fragmented in that men average 1.3 sleep episodes of somewhat less than 6 hour duration in 24 hours, but the total daily quantity of sleep was considered adequate. And subjective sleep quality was slightly lower on patrol than in a post-patrol period. They say that while there was a lot of sleepiness reported 50% of the time, they do point out that the stability of their environment actually seems to make them sleep better and report less sleepiness than other active duty environments on the surface.
Yeah, this is a thing that I wouldn't have considered before I read about this, but that when you're on a surface vessel, of course, you're dealing with the rocking of the waves and all that. You got to get your sea legs basically, right? But when you are on a submerged submarine in the deep, apparently it feels very stable. You might as well be on the surface.
That's right. The paper says, quote, sleep on submarines may be considered mildly fragmented in the sense that daily sleep quota is not taken in a single episode at a usual time of day. Even for men standing 6-18 watches, shipboard sleep is considerably more irregular than in most shore settings. The quality of sleep is somewhat lower on patrol than at home, but the sleep quality indices do not suggest that sleep quality is so poor as to be considered a problem. The slight reduction in sleep quality may be related to the 18-hour cycle or simply to shipboard living conditions.
Now, considering sleep on modern submarines, one thing I've read about in multiple sources is specifically it's a slang term that's used in British Royal Navy subs. But apparently crew members have a slang term for a common type of nightmare or possibly based on the reports what seems to me like maybe a hypnopompic hallucination state.
This would be a hallucination you experience as you're in that netherworld between being awake and being asleep.
As you're waking up, yeah. Specifically, as opposed to the hypnagogic hallucination, which tends to be when you're falling asleep.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're called coffin dreams. So just a few things I've read about them from a 2003 Telegraph article I was reading about life aboard Royal Navy submarines. Quote, the men grab what sleep they can, racked three deep in dark cabins with barely a foot of space between the opposing rows of bunks. They, quote, hot bunk, sharing the use of a rack with a shipmate working on an alternate watch. Sometimes they get, quote, coffin dreams, nightmares from which they come to in the close dark, not knowing where they are, and panic.
Oh.
And so I've read that, for example, the coffin dreams can be triggered by a sense of claustrophobia, maybe even actually thinking you are waking up in some type of coffin or container, because according to the Friends of the Royal Navy Submarine Museum, basically, in a sleeping condition on a typical submarine bunk, you've got another bunk maybe close above you or a flat surface like a roof right above you with like an inch or two clear all around your body basically. I mean, it just doesn't sound like there's much room to move. And I can imagine waking up in that state could be terrifying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and imagine if you just come to, you're just going to go – face first or the back of the head first right into the bulkhead.
Exactly. Or the person below you, if you're stacked on bunks, might be kneeing you and stuff while they wake up having a coffin dream. On a totally unscientific online poll I found on the Friends of the Royal Navy Submarine Museum website, So, you know, unscientific poll, but for what it's worth, 38% of respondents on this online poll claim to have had coffin dreams when they were aboard submarines. And then from a 2012 article in The Guardian by Stephen Moss, in which he experiences life aboard a nuclear submarine, he writes, quote, "Several men mention coffin dreams, nightmares in which the sleeper shouts out that the control room is flooding or he is being pursued by a torpedo. I sympathize. I have no nightmares. I don't sleep deeply enough for that. The racks do feel like coffins."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've definitely personally had the experience of my environment, the environment in which I'm sleeping, seeming to affect my dreams or maybe hypnopompic hallucinations as I'm waking up. But yeah, I've never experienced anything like this, nothing this cramped, nothing this strange. And pile that on all of the strange environmental stresses that exist in normal life while you're on a submarine. So these experiences are piling up while you're awake throughout the day, and then you go sleep in the coffin. It's not hard to see why you would get certain types of nightmares being very common and recurrent.
Yeah, and depending on during, you know, which era you are sleeping, you're talking about all sorts of repressed anxiety about torpedoes seeking you out, of depth charges, of the actual terrible purpose that these nuclear weapon equipped subs are tasked with. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you.
I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we've been talking about life aboard nuclear submarines, especially when they remain submerged for long periods of time and how that affects the psychology of crew members and especially the sleep of the crew members. But I thought we maybe should look at a couple more sources before we wrap it up for today.
Yeah, and these are far more recent sources. There's one titled Three Decades of Nuclear Submarine Research, Implications for Space and Antarctic Research. And this came from Benjamin B. Weybrew, and he pointed out some of the following points. He mentions that it's sometimes called inner space as opposed to outer space.
Okay, so we're back to Quaid territory.
Right. And he also mentions that bathophobia is very real, as opposed to the fear of depressurization in space.
So would this be fear of what, of the submarine being crushed like a tin can?
Yeah, just
the ocean?
Knowing all that pressure out there. He also points out that the submerged missions of 30 to 80 days progress. There also is this tendency to worry more about the possibilities of atmospheric contaminants.
Yeah, I mean, you got to worry if your air is clean, right?
Well, you think of like a lot of the things we fear in life, we fear change. Mm-hmm. And you have such a static environment, you have to look to the areas where change can occur, such as air quality or machine failure.
Now, when we were talking about William Beebe in the bathysphere, mm-hmm. I remember one of the creepiest thoughts I had about it was that, okay, this is a heavier-than-water vessel that's being lowered down basically on a chain. What would happen if it were to have its connection to the surface vessel severed? Well, this bathysphere, it would just sink, right? It'd just sink to the bottom of the ocean and you'd be done.
Right, but there's similar concerns in place with the nuclear submarine. Loss of power could prevent the sub's ability to blow ballast and return to the surface.
At least in the examples at this time.
Right, yeah. At least in these examples. And during all this, Weybrew points out that the individuals may experience sleep problems and diurnal flattening. So, again, we're just coming back to the idea that circadian rhythm is disrupted by the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this point that he makes. This was interesting as well. Quote, psychologists specializing in vision demonstrated in the late 1940s that the close viewing distance in subs caused the lateral foreas to become esophoric. In response to this finding, it was recommended that landscapes and seascapes with deep depth cues be installed on the bulkheads of selected compartments.
So esophoria is the tendency of the eyes to want to turn inward more than they need to when focusing on something close up.
Hmm.
So if I'm interpreting that correctly, that seems like there could be a risk of submariners going cross-eyed.
Yeah, I mean, because again, you have to realize that we, of course, did not evolve to live within a submarine, within a confined tube. We evolved to live in a much more open world, and that's what our eyes are designed to take in.
Right. If you're just constantly looking at stuff close to your face all the time, like say maybe you're a person who's always staring at a computer screen or you're in a tightly closed environment. Yeah. I mean, you got to wonder if that's messing with your vision to some extent. And so it sounds like here they're saying we need to put in place something that at least gives them the feeling of being able to look at something far away.
Yeah. Okay, let's put a motivational poster up on this bulkhead. This also seems where movie night would have become essential, mm-hmm. you know, and might have dictated the type of movies that they would have watched. You get something with some nice wide open countryside, maybe some Westerns.
I recommend Orson Welles movies for those the deep focus scenes, right, where you can mm-hmm. see the focus way in the back of the field of what they're shooting.
Yeah, let's have a few showings of Touch of Evil aboard the ship. Now, the author also identified, quote, effects of absence of circadian cues upon sleep, noise level, work overload and underload, and environmental conditions tending to produce boredom and fatigue. However, there's good news. He says that the incidence of acute or chronic psychopathology during during long missions is incredibly low, between only 1 and 4%.
But wait a minute. If you got a crew of 140, that means you got at least one statistically.
Well,
who's not doing great.
Yeah, and I guess that's why you have a doc on board, right?
Uh-huh.
To mitigate those situations. He also brings up something that was that was apparently introduced as a way to mitigate some of these other effects, and that is periscope liberty.
Well, what does that mean?
So the idea here is that you would let crew members glance at the outside world through the periscope for the purpose of, quote, cognitive anchoring. And this is also interesting as well. He points out that errors in time perception tend to occur in the direction of overestimation of time intervals, which makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're bored and you're fatigued, you might say, oh, man, I can't believe we've been down here 3 months. And then Greg turns to you and says, this is day three.
Yeah.
And in closing, the author points out a few key areas of concern for that we can take away from all this when we consider Arctic submarine and space missions of the future. He points out atmospheric revitalization and contaminant control, development and validation of procedures for the medical and psychological screening of recruits, identification of techniques for initiating and sustaining individual motivation and group morale, stressor identification, assessment of the severity of POSR, or patterns of stress reactivity for person, and development of effective stress coping strategies.
Now, I wonder to what extent those actually do get mapped on to how we deal with life, say, aboard the International Space Station.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we don't send just anybody up to the ISS. There is a rigorous screening and then training regime in place to get you there.
I have heard a lot less about issues of motivation relating to astronauts. Maybe it's there, but I feel like I've read a good bit about what life is like aboard the ISS and accounts of the astronauts who were there. And I don't remember hearing a lot about problems with, say, individual motivation or group morale.
Yeah, and as far as the idea of a lazy astronaut, that is as science fiction a concept as we can possibly bring up on the show, because at this stage in space exploration, you've really got to want to be there.
I guess maybe things would be different if we were talking about crewed orbiting satellites that were there for the purpose of maintaining a nuclear deterrent.
Right, right, and or forcing somebody to watch bad movies.
Right.
But you could do both. That's the thing. You could do both.
I see you there.
Now, there have been some recent changes. As reported by the Associated Press in 2014, the Navy began experimenting with 14-hour days as opposed to the 18-hour activity cycles that had been the standard.
Mm-hmm.
The article says, quote, submarine crews are not big enough to support more than three watch rotations, and beginning in the 1960s, the Navy capped shifts at 6 hours, in part to limit fatigue as sailors manned the vessel's nuclear reactors. But the study by the Naval Submarine Medical Research Laboratory at the submarine base in Groton documented weariness that can set in every third cycle as sailors are working when their bodies are accustomed to sleeping. So the Navy laboratory in Groton conducted experiments beginning in 2005 looking at sleep patterns, melatonin levels, and all this through various monitoring devices and saliva swabs. However, it's worth noting that when the attack sub Scranton tried out this new activities cycle during a 7-month deployment, the new schedule initially caused laundry backlogs and frustration over laptop and exercise equipment availability.
Laundry backlogs?
Yeah.
What's the causal connection there?
That one is not as clear to me. I mean, I can imagine the laptop and exercise machine, right?
Uh-huh.
Because suddenly there's more overlap in wakefulness, and there's more demand for these devices. And of course, the mention of laptops also brings up the idea, like, your modern submariner has an entirely different situation compared to the submariner of the past.
Uh-huh.
Because in addition to the evening movie, you've got, I mean, certainly you're not connected to the World Wide Web, but you have all the potential of a laptop computer. Maybe even episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind to get you through the trip.
Oh, yeah. Are you listening to us on a nuclear submarine right now? If so, let us know when you come back to when you come back within radio range.
Yeah, obviously, we would love to hear from anyone out there who has served on a nuclear submarine.
Now, if a lot of the stress of the submarine environment is due to isolation from the outside world and sort of a lack of exposure to nature, lack of exposure to sunlight and the cramped, claustrophobic conditions, I wonder if this is not a really prime opportunity for virtual reality therapy. We've talked plenty of times about virtual reality therapy on the show before, and there are lots of ways it could be used, right? One of the important ways that I often think about is most interesting about virtual reality is the sense that it can give you that your body is different than what it is. Mm. And this can be used for all kinds of medical therapies. But of course, on the submarine, I would imagine the main thing would be the more traditional type of virtual reality, which is that your environment is different than what it is. It could give you some depth of field to look at that's full of nice and nurturing kind of natural environments. So the same way the crew of the Enterprise can go to the holodeck, right, mm-hmm. and hang out by a cool running stream in the forest, maybe the members of a submarine crew on deep submerged time could get convincing doses of surface time through VR.
That makes sense because also this is technology that would not take up much space. It's not like installing a holodeck on your submarine.
I looked for research testing this out, and I wasn't able to find anything, but I would kind of be surprised if somebody wasn't trying this or at least talking about trying to try it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously you don't want a lawnmower man situation on your nuclear submarine, but it seems like there's a lot of positive potential here.
Yeah, keep Jeff Fahey off of that thing.
All right, well, there you have it. I think this was a pretty delightful episode. We got to talk a little bit about nuclear submarines and the prospect of nuclear war, but got to bring it down to just the basic relatable situation of trying to sleep in strange places and trying to sleep through your various worries. If you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes, including this one, including that There But For Science episode we referenced earlier. And also you'll find links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. As always, I want to remind everyone, if you want to support this show, definitely rate and review Stuff to Blow Your Mind wherever you get your podcasts.
Big thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback about this episode or any other episode, to let us know a topic you think maybe we should cover in the future, or to just say hi, let us know where you're listening from, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the App and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.